Without any further ado, I'm going to pass it on to Anna Rose MacArthur, who's going to host this special edition of Coffee at KYUK. Anna Rose?
Good morning. Thank you, Grady. I'm here for a special legislative update, and I'm joined by Senator Lyman Hoffman, who's calling in from Juneau. Senator, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Anna Rose. Down here in Juneau, it's been snowing for several hours. We probably have about 5 inches of snow since last night, so it's about 30 degrees, no wind, but very little happening here in the Capitol building.
Well, Senator, some of the big news coming out of the legislature deals with the governor's proposed budget amendments. They would cut education by $20 million and the Village Public Safety Officer Program by $3 million. You serve as a Senate Finance Committee member, and will you explain how the process of this proposed budget works?
Well, the way that that works is we passed legislation last year, Senate Bill 142, which I architected in the Senate, that helped us get out of the special session. Constituents may remember 2 years ago we went well over 200 days. It was one of the longest sessions in state history, and we were faced with the potential of having a similar situation, us going all the way into the summer. But we worked with the other body, and one of the key pieces of legislation was Senate Bill 142, which basically said that if the House adopted Senate Bill 26, which was the money that would go toward using a portion of the permanent fund, 5.25% for government and for dividends. So that was passed, and the House agreed. We early funded this year's budget, plus we gave in FY19 an additional $20 million, and then we passed HB 287, which gives next year, FY20, an additional $30 million. So I think Governor Dunleavy's administration is trying to claw back that appropriation. I've heard a lot of opposition to that, as well as the $3 million that that he wants to take away from the VPSO program. To give the members some idea, the listening audience some idea of how much we're talking about, in the Lower Kuskokwim School District, this would take away $1,056,000 out of their budget. It would also take away Yupik School District, $125,000. We have the Lower Yukon District, which would receive $563,000 less. It is substantial, and I asked at the Senate Finance table, what about the additional $30 million for FY20, which is next year? And they said we would find out about that appropriation when he comes out with his amendments to the operating budget right around Valentine's Day. But that would, if he does take that appropriation, that would mean an additional $1,584,000 away from the Lower Kuskokwim School District, and for the Lower Yukon School District, another $845,000. So throughout the state, you know, I think many, if not all of the school districts have already contemplated spending at least the $20 million in supplementals that the legislature appropriated. And because of that, I think that there is a very little enthusiasm at least in the Senate, for clawing back this $20 million and taking it away from school districts that have already planned on utilizing it.
And will you just explain, as a Finance Committee member, what is your role in then executing and planning out the budget along with what the governor wants, along with other legislatures wants. You served on the Finance Committee for more than a decade, with many of those years as co-chair. And so what is the process that the Finance Committee is going to undergo to create its budget?
Well, in this scenario, he's asking us to repeal an existing statute that's been signed into law. There's some question as to whether or not he can legally not dispense those funds, and that is a question that is being researched as we speak. But you know, I think that one thing that the members should, from the listening audience, particularly those in the education community, should realize that we, the legislature, for over two decades have never forward-funded education, and we forward-funded education for FY19 last year. So that is in play, and I would say that as we look forward to Governor Dunleavy's budget amendments, I would say that additional reductions could be anticipated by the Dunleavy administration to claw back additional revenues that have been already approved for FY19.
And listeners, please join the conversation by calling in 543-5985, or you can call in toll-free at 1-800-995-8954.
I might expound on that a little bit. These dollars are a little bit more protected. When we're talking about appropriations for FY20, and say the governor proposed $1 million someplace, and then we decided to spend $2 million and sent it to his desk, he could veto that amount back down to $1 million. In this case, if we say no to his $20 million reduction on an appropriation that already exists, he cannot veto the money back in. So I think the at least for FY19's appropriation and the supplemental of additional $20 million, if it's completely in the legislator's preview to decide whether or not those dollars go forward. It is not something that Governor Dunleavy has authority to override the legislature on.
And we have a caller. We have Mark Springer calling in from Bethel. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning, Senator Hopkin. Appreciate your opening the phone lines up to us.
Good morning, Mark.
We all really appreciate your deep interest in education, not just here on the Delta, but statewide. And, of course, your outstanding expertise on the budget process. So there's a little bit of controversy, really, going on with the administration with the hiring of Nikki Shabaka, who is the husband of the newly appointed acting commissioner of administration. And there's a report this morning on Dermot Cole's website pointing out that Mr. Shabaka is going to get paid $139,000 as an assistant commissioner of education, with kind of a very broad and hard to define job description. And the point gets made, and this is apparently right from the administration, that the money is not in the education budget for that job, and he's going to be paid for with what they call interagency receipts. Is it an appropriate use of state money, especially when it's not in the budget, to essentially seemingly create a job for the spouse of somebody that you've hired for a top executive position, maybe as a carrot? I mean, I'm not saying that that's what it was, but there's that. And could you address the issue of interagency receipts? Why should the Department of Fish and Game or DOT or the Department of Public Safety be contributing to a newly created position in the Department of Education that you know, doesn't even have much of a clear description? And I will I'll listen to that. Thank you, sir, for everything you do for us, letting us, you know.
Yes, thank you, Mark. The budgetary process, we authorize appropriations for from general funds for specific purposes within a budget reserve unit or BRU. And that those dollars get scrutinized quite heavily by the legislature because those are real dollars. When we look at interagency receipts, they are not as highly scrutinized. But I would say that as you explain the use of these interagency receipts, I would say that it falls into a gray area, and I will read Dermot Cole's article on this, you know, and I think that it's unusual if the salary amount is high and it falls into a gray area because of the individual being, it looks like an appointee of or a friend of someone else, and that is probably going to get a lot of scrutiny from not only my office but other offices in the building. But the further thing that people should know is that Governor Dunleavy professes to be a fiscal conservative, and for his administration to go out and create jobs through interagency receipts seems to be going around the appropriation process, and instead of tightening his belt, he's doing just the opposite, which again raises red flags. So, Mark, I will be looking into this, and whatever additional information I find, I will get to get back to you and Anna Rose on any developments that may transpire in the immediate and near future.
And Senator Hoffman, Governor Dunleavy has proposed amendments to the Alaska Constitution. The amendments would require public votes for any new or increased taxes, as well as for changes to permanent fund dividends, and would limit state spending increases. To pass, these amendments would require support from two-thirds of both legislative chambers this year or next, and a majority of the voting public. These amendments have been referred to the Senate Finance Committee, where you serve, Senator Hoffman, and under what criteria is the committee scrutinizing these amendments?
Well, we would be looking at the language, what the intent is. The one that is probably going to get a lot of attention is the one that requires voter approval for new taxes. When you talk about a two-thirds requirement, that is a very, very high standard. We have exactly 14 members in the majority in the Senate, and the normal process for getting something to the floor, let alone past the Finance Committee, I might skip that, the Finance Committee referral first, is that it has to have the number of votes in the caucus in order to get it calendared. That would mean if the rule is followed by the leadership of the Senate, that every single member of the majority would have to agree to whatever version of the constitutional amendment and how it would read as it entered the Rules Committee. So every single member of the majority, if the rule is followed, carries a veto on not getting that bill calendared. So that is a rule that has been followed quite religiously. I know that there's been some very waivers of this rule in the past, and whether that waiver will take place in either or any of the constitutional proposed amendments by the governor remains to be seen. But all of them, it's hard to say because we have to go through what's called markup in the Finance Committee, voting on amendments, and seeing what the final version of the bill would look like. So I guess it's hard for me to say whether I plan on supporting or opposing any of these until I see the last version, and whether or not after I review the constitutional amendments as proposed by Governor Dan Levy, whether I might have amendments to the proposed constitutional bills or not is something that I'm looking forward to after I review the and hear the presentation by the administration.
As someone who's served in the Senate Finance Committee for many years, what initial questions do you have for the amendment to require public votes for any new or increased taxes?
Well, I think that whether or not those new taxes or increases are just for the general fund, or is it for other funds? Can this go down to boroughs, to cities, to local governments? And my questions come up in that regard, because I think that if it's spread down to different layers of government, those different layers of government should be the ones that are going to be deciding on whether or not they want voter approval or voter ratification in their local governments or boroughs. So those are some of the questions that need to be answered. And I think that the standard of whether or not what level the taxes have to be approved at, many times they require a 40% or a 60% approval rate before anything goes forward, and I know that will also generate a lot of discussion and dialogue. So there's so many different rabbit trails that can that we can go down when we're talking about something as important as a constitutional amendment.
And the partisan power balance shifted this legislative session to a Republican majority Senate, with you serving as the only Democrat in that majority caucus. How did you make that happen?
Well, I wanted in one capacity or another, whether it was going to be as a minority member, I believe I would have been serving as a Finance Committee member, but I think I best serve my district by being in the majority, by listening to the dialogue in our caucus meetings. And I think over the years I've developed a working relationship with just about every single member in the Senate. There are some new ones that I'm getting to know, but I think it's being straightforward, speaking your mind, and first and foremost, listening to what is best for the constituency that I represent, and understanding that each and every senator has their own constituencies, and we have to work together and work across party lines to make sure that we respect their opinion and they respect my opinion and the position of my constituents.
Senator, you of course serve in the state Senate, but the state House has yet to form a majority or elect a House Speaker, and this means that lawmakers in the House have been unable to introduce bills, hold committee meetings, or formally consider Governor Dunleavy's proposed budget. Is this gridlock that it's occurring in the House in any way affecting the functions of the Senate, or if it goes on, how will it affect the functions of the Senate?
Well, it is affecting the functions of the Senate, primarily of who we have to deal with. When the Senate President makes referrals on at least Senate bills that were being introduced, it would be interesting to see what type of interest the other body has and where those bills may go, and it also, as the listening audience should know, the normal process for the budget, operating budget and the capital budget, is that they get introduced and they get heard by the House of Representatives, and they are then referred to the Senate for our deliberation. And being into the third week, it is putting additional pressure, I think, in the whole building. And I would say that, you know, we can basically throw out a 90-day session, which would have ended around April 15th. But I think that now there's question of whether or not we can get our work done in a 120-day session if the clock started ticking on January the 15th. Everyone knows that we are a citizen legislators, and we have lives outside of our legislative responsibilities, and for us to be tied up past 120 days into, which would be right around May 15th and possibly longer into June, is something that no legislator wants to look forward to. Many people say we're down here to collect per diem, but really we want to get the job done, and we want to get on with our lives outside of the legislature.
Well, Senator Hoffman, thank you so much for joining us this morning. We're going to have to leave it there. We're hoping to hold more call-ins like this as the legislative session continues, and we'll see how long it continues this year. Senator Hoffman, thank you.
Thank you very much, and everybody in the YK Delta, have a great day.
I'm Anna Rose MacArthur. Thanks for listening. Grady, back to you.
Only leaves one thing left for me to say, and that's don't forget to be awesome to each other. Each weekday, a member of the community is invited to coffee at KYUK. Sometimes light, sometimes serious, it's where our community connects. If you'd like to be a guest on Coffee at KYUK, contact me at coffee@kyuk.org or directly at Grady@kyuk.org.